KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
We think it's going to take about 33,000 wells to produce this oil field. And so we're not even 10% of where we need to be when we get to the end of this drilling phase.
The last three consecutive re-elected presidents were Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. And that's, you know, almost 200 years ago.
How can we put in place good evaluation systems? How can we put in place options for families so that every kid has a shot to go to an excellent school?
Michelle Rhee, talking about how to reform education. We talked to her yesterday, the former superintendent of Washington, D.C. schools. Today we're going to hear a counter voice in education reform, Dora Taylor. She's part of the Seattle Education blog, works with parents. We also heard from David Domke there. David Domke is doing a series of lectures about how to win the White House in 2016. And today he's going to talk about getting the party base all riled up and what that means. And we start on weekday on KUOW Seattle, where I am Steve Scherr, with the debate over fracking and what specifically fracking, the new oil boom, looks like in North Dakota, where unemployment's about 3% and people are moving back to the region after years of it emptying out. Parents are seeing their children come back and finding good jobs. But what does it mean? What does extracting all those millions of barrels of the back of oil field mean for the regional economy, the environment, and the world? Because it's a big question. Richard Manning is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, author. His cover story in the March Harper's Magazine is Back in Business. Ha-ha. I didn't get the joke before. The Price of North Dakota's Fracking Boom. His ninth book, It Runs in the Family, is coming out this year from St. Martin's Press. Richard Manning, thanks a lot.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve.
By the way, that's how you pronounce it, right? Back in business.
Bakken, yeah. Actually, Bakken.
But you were going for the pun. They were going for the pun, though.
Pardon me?
They were going for the pun.
Yeah, I think so. They might have been, yeah.
All right, what prompted you to drive over there from your North Dakota home?
Well, I'm actually in Montana.
Montana home, sorry.
Yeah, and Montana is a part of the Bakken boom as well, that the formation extends into eastern Montana as well. But I kept hearing stories about it, just people going there to get jobs, you know, guys who had been flipping burgers were all of a sudden making six figures driving truck, and there was this migration. So it sounded like a great sucking sound in that side of the state, and I thought I'd go over and have a look.
Yeah, one of the things you describe is how difficult it is for some city departments to keep workers because even garbage truck drivers are getting recruited right out of the cab.
Yeah, they'll literally leave the truck idling beside the road and go off to make that six-figure salary. So anybody with a commercial license works, commercial truck license.
All right, remind us again how big this oil field is. First of all, how big is it?
Well, it's about 50,000 square miles, if that makes sense to anybody, or 15,000. But it's about a third of North Dakota, if you can imagine that, which is very similar to the size of Washington. So imagine a third of Washington State, and you've got a pretty good idea. On the western edge, it's not clear how big it is. It's being explored, but it extends into Montana and into Alberta and Saskatchewan as well.
And how much oil is potentially down there?
Well, potentially is the interesting question, because that potential, they've got a pretty good idea, and it's a lot. It's the numbers are in the story, but it's on the order of all the proven reserves in the United States that we already have. The interesting question is how much of it they can recover with current technologies. And the numbers keep changing as they get better at it, but they're in the range of 6 to 10% of that. So people have called it the Kuwait of the United States, or the new Kuwait of the world, and that's probably not wrong.
Wow, I mean this is a changing moment for the oil industry and for the world as they move to extract this. I want to come back to that, but describe the towns that are booming. What do they look like?
Well, if you have never seen a typical Northern Plains town, it's kind of difficult to describe in some ways. But before, they were very tiny wheat farming towns, typically 3,000, 4,000 people. and isolated and in the middle of the Great Plains. Within a matter of 2 or 3 years, many of those towns have tripled in size. And it's just, it's a boom. And there's no other way to describe it but as a boom. And they've done that by adding things they call man camps, which will be, they look like FEMA trailers or house trailers that this in perfect rows of literally thousands of them, with thousands of guys living in them, working in the oil fields.
And then as you point out in your article, Richard Manning, back in business, the price of North Dakota's fracking boom, which is in Harper's, there are, this means that carpenters and plumbers and all sorts of other people are coming because it's expected to be producing oil for a while, and therefore they are building up the infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it starts out with the truck drivers and oil field workers, but it really requires every kind of person you can imagine to do the job. So, for instance, in one point in Williston, North Dakota, the Walmart was flying in people from Minneapolis to work in the Walmart because that's the only other way they could get staff. It's that kind of a boom.
People are coming from far and wide to work there, including Washington State, right? You run into people from all over who are working in North Dakota now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially timber towns, for instance. So, timber towns in Montana, where people were working as loggers, those skills translated almost instantly to the kind of skills they needed. So they went there to work.
And the people that live there and have been sharing their oil land through, if they own leases or if they don't own leases, which is an interesting part of the story, or mineral rights, I should say, those people are experiencing the boom as a double-edged sword. What's the negative for them?
Yeah, absolutely, and it varies. It depends on who you talk to, how much money they're making on the deal. So business people, for instance, are doing quite well. A lot of people are very happy that their kids have moved back because those kids now have jobs. And the Northern Plains is an area of depopulation, so families typically fragmented. But other people are weary of the congestion, the high price of housing, traffic, and it's more than traffic. It's actually quite dangerous to drive on the roads now because of all the truck traffic. And so those complaints accumulate as well. And then on top of that, there's crime, there's prostitution, there's a really pretty prevalent public alcoholism, drug use, so all the things that go with a boom town.
Who is making the money off the oil? Do the farmers who sit on the land own the mineral rights?
Not often. So the mineral, it's interesting that that place has very large farms, 2,000-3,000 acres, more often ranches than farms. They're cattle raising places. But they were assembled piecemeal after homesteaders went broke during the Great Depression. Often those homesteaders have sold off their mineral rights. So the mineral rights are also piecemeal, and they belong to other people, often absentee. So very often ranchers will have oil wells on their land, and they make no money from it other than some right-of-way costs, things like that. There's some money there in leasing, but it accrues to a lot of different people. But most of the money is being made by employment. The guy's actually working and spending money in the place.
Richard Manning has written about the fracking boom in North Dakota for Harper's Magazine. North Dakota, the third producing state. No, it's now the second producing state. Where's North Dakota rank now in terms of oil production?
That's right. It's second, right behind Texas. And while I was writing this story, it passed first California and then Alaska. So now North Dakota produces more oil than Alaska, which is a little mind-boggling. And it did so in a period of about 3 years.
And the Bakken oil, it sits between two thick layers of rock, and it's, people describe it as an Oreo cookie.
Yeah, and exactly. And there are two dark layers of rock that are really predictable and extend in that broad area we talked about earlier. And then a central area of rock that is, on the order of 50 to 100 feet thick. And that's where all the oil's trapped in the pores in that shale. So they obtain that by drilling down, straight down, like any normal oil well, into that layer of rock for about 2 miles. But then they put a 90-degree bend in the pipeline. in the well casing and drill horizontally for another maybe 2 or 3 miles.
And the breakthrough for the oil drillers in terms of technology is their increased understanding of how to use materials, water, plugs, in order to create these oozing pockets that they can just drain the water, the oil from, for years.
Yeah, and that's all fracking. And so fracking is really what opened up this oil field and similar oil fields across the country. There are probably 20 deposits like this in the United States. So that's the real revolutionary part of this, is that the Bakken is sort of a vanguard. They figured out what they call the recipe, the specific tools they needed to extract the oil from here. And that recipe and the techniques they used will hold up in some of those other oil fields across the nation, which will really revolutionize the nation's energy picture. We are no longer in danger of running out of oil.
Yeah, the people who talked about peak oil have to recalculate if all these places are tapped. You talk about fields in Texas, for example, that look like if they're tappable, and they appear to be, could be producing oil for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Texas fields are already pretty well developed. And then we also have a lot of natural gas stuff like Marcellus Shale in the Northeast that we've heard quite a bit about the fracking there. Probably the only reason they're not more fully developed right now is the price of natural gas is quite low. But as we figure out ways to build infrastructure for natural gas, we'll see a lot more development of these oil fields.
So low that in North Dakota, they're flaring the natural gas.
Yeah, they're flaring the natural gas because there's not sufficient infrastructure to pipe it off to where it might be used. So and natural gas is kind of an interesting fuel in that it's cleaner than a lot of other fuels. But we're burning it off in North Dakota enough to heat about 500,000 homes. So a good-sized city could be heated with the gas that is simply burned off as waste there. And I saw this happening literally within sight of a coal-fired power plant. So we're burning very dirty, carbon-generating coal and wasting the natural gas.
And as you write in your article, Richard Manning, also there are holding ponds where all the material from the fracking wells ends up in water, and a slurry of water and chemicals, toluene, benzene, it was checked. And some of those are affected by floodwaters from the Missouri and other rivers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fracking is a labor-intensive process and also water-intensive process, and both of those facts are probably more dangerous than the chemicals involved, just because it generates so much water, and water is hard to control. So it's using water in an arid area, but also discharging that water, and it has to go someplace, and it ends up often in the streams, as you pointed out. But also, each one of those wells requires something like 1,200 truck trips during its first year. And they're drilling something like 35,000, 40,000 wells in North Dakota. So you do the math on that, and you can see a constant stream of trucks and people and everything that goes with it. It's really a pretty intensive process.
President Obama talked about climate change. Some people who heard them think, well, he's not going to authorize that pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline, because it hauls oil and gas, tar sands from Canada. But the Bakken oil field is also at some point connected to the system that would be bringing oil out of that into that pipeline as well, right?
Yeah, it could be. So the current plans for the Keystone call for what they call an on-ramp at Baker, Montana. And basically that's a spot in the pipe where they'll add Bakken oil into the mix and start piping that around as well. So Bakken's dependent on that. And you say, well, okay, we can stop this development by stopping the pipelines, but that's simply not true. So they're using trains and trucks now to export that oil, export it or move it to Oklahoma. Most of it goes to Oklahoma where it's refined. And so it's far more complex than the pipeline. There's a whole infrastructure of trucks, trains, and existing pipelines that move that oil around. And that will be true of the tar sands oil as well.
Well, this is we're at a conundrum here. We're talking about embracing climate change from the federal government and dealing with our use of fossil fuels. At the same time, would any president make an effort? You know, it's okay to stop Canadian jobs, but are they going to stop American jobs from sprouting up in these oil fields?
Well, and that's really the point here, is that fracking opens up so much oil and so much employment at the same time that no politician is going to say no to this. And this is not even a matter of party. And we can put some window dressing on it and posture and say we're dealing with global warming. But when this much energy exists, and it really does raise our energy reserves by an order of magnitude, when it exists, we're going to get it. We're going to drill it, and global warming consequences be damned.
Richard Manning is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author. Back in Business, The Price of North Dakota's Fracking Boom is the cover story in a March Harper's Magazine. His ninth book, It Runs in the Family, is coming out from St. Martin's Press. There's a lot of great stuff in this article. I recommend you read it. Thank you, Richard Manning.
Thank you, Steve.
Take care. Now we'll talk about school reform in a moment and much more ahead on Weekday.
-44 degrees in Seattle under a cloudy sky. Forecast calls for rain at times through the day with an afternoon high of 46.
Support for KUOW comes from the 20th Annual Wintergrass, Bluegrass, and Acoustic Music Festival, February 28th through March 3rd in Bellevue. 4 days, 4 stages, 70 shows, and 500 mandolins. Lineup includes David Grisman, The Seldom Seen, and Daryl Anger. Information and updates online at wintergrass.com.
It's 9:21. I'm Bernard Ouellette. UW communication professor David Domke is laying out a few rules for upcoming presidential candidates. Rule 2 is, to become president, you must be loved by your party's base. He'll join us to expand upon that idea in 20 minutes.
But first, controversial education change advocate Michelle Rhee spoke in Seattle Tuesday night. She was met by protests from people opposed to her support for high-stakes testing and ending seniority as the deciding factor for keeping and promoting teachers. Dora Taylor is Seattle Education blog writer. She is also a founding member and on the board of directors of Parents Across America, a nonprofit advocacy group that wants to see more parents involved and a smarter approach to education reform. We'll talk about what that means. She's also an architect, teaches introductory classes in architecture to students in grades 3 through high school. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a nice little segue here. How are you teaching classes to students in grade 3 through high school? Where do you do that?
Right now, I do that actually either after school on Saturdays and during the summer. I offer summer camps.
Are you associated with any particular school, or are you doing it as an independent?
I work as an independent.
This is the kind of change to the education system, a parent with knowledge, that you would like to see embraced by school districts?
Actually, I would. I would. I see that as an opportunity for people who have experience in different fields to be able to provide to students additional knowledge that they might not otherwise be privy to.
What are good approaches to school reform? I know that's a huge question to start, but what are good approaches at the broadest sense that you think would help make schools more responsive to parents, to legislators, to businesses, you know, all the different forces that want to see schools change?
Well, first of all, I think we need to look at what works in our own communities. We have a lot of successful programs here in Seattle, as there are in every part of the country. We have successful programs like what we used to call alternative schools. I refer to them as progressive alternative schools. Now they're referred to as option schools.
For example, which ones do you like?
Nova High School, Center, Tops, Salmon Bay. They all have a waiting list, which indicates that they're highly regarded. For instance, Nova is a project-based, student-oriented program that one I know of very well because my daughter attended that school.
Why aren't more of these programs, why aren't they replicated in other schools if they work?
Actually, the STEM program, there was a lot of
science, technology, education, math.
Right. The new one at Cleveland, The principal there worked very closely with the principal at Nova High School when they were developing their curriculum, which is also project-based. Why it isn't replicated is a good question. I think some of it has to do with funding. These schools are generally smaller in size. I think if there were either more teachers or smaller class sizes, you could do more of that work.
More teachers and more class sizes and smaller class sizes.
One or the other. you need one or the other to succeed.
Why have we gone down the road of high stakes testing when we talk about school reform, in your opinion?
I think that for some people, they see that as the easy way to evaluate how a student is doing. And this approach was started by people who are not in the field of education, so they really don't understand. They think that it's a fast and easy way to just look at test scores and analyze how students are doing. But we all understand that there are many factors involved when a child takes a test.
Well, why have we ended up with, I mean, I remember covering the school reform movement starting in the 80s, and where we evolved into the WASL tests, and then we've abandoned those tests and we've moved on to other ways of evaluating schools. Why have we continued to follow that path? I'm asking you that as a parent and an activist. I mean, what do you see happening?
Well, what's been happening is that first of all, we still have a WASL type test. It's a state test called the CSEP. But what is happening is that now there's even more testing on top of that. So, for instance, we have the MAP test.
The measure of academic progress.
Right. What's been happening is that there's been, along with this, there's been an approach by certain people to begin to create charter schools and put public schools into the hands of private enterprise or organizations.
Well, do you think that's because of a monetary issue, or is it because people are thrashing around for ways to not graduate students who can't read and write at grade level?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think some people, and again, when you look at what we refer to as the ed reform movement at this point, it is being driven by people who are not educators. And again, so their approach is quite frankly, and not based in reality.
Well, their argument is, educators have failed, teachers' unions are too strong, they protect bad teachers, we need to figure out a way to get bad teachers out and good teachers, young or old, staying and getting higher pay.
It isn't that simplistic. First of all, in terms of looking at our own union here in Seattle, the Seattle Education Association, they have just developed another program, an evaluation program, and I believe it's a 5-step program. Let's give that a chance before we start firing teachers and hiring Teach for America to replace them. Also, if you look at models like in Finland, which we seem to want to look at right now because they have such high PISA scores, every teacher there has a master's degree. They're treated like professionals. They are regarded as in high regard as any doctor would be there.
So Dora Taylor is a writer at the Seattle Education Blog. She's an active parent, founding member, and board of director member of Parents Across America, which works to bring parents into the discussion about teacher and education reform. Also an architect. Well, there is where you and Michelle Rhee seem to agree. Professionalize, elevate the status of teachers, pay them more, and that will bring more people into the profession who will stick around and be able to stick around because they'll be on an incentive track to higher pay. What's wrong with that idea? As a critic of Michelle Rhee, what's wrong with that idea?
There's nothing wrong with that idea. But having, for instance, she pushes legislation. In Finland, there is no legislation. The principal is treated as a professional. The teachers are treated as professionals. They're the people who determine curriculum. They're the people who determine programs, not state senators and representatives.
How should we evaluate teachers based on a student's performance?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know. That is not in part of my purview because I'm not a teacher per se. My sense is that we shouldn't. If we do, it should be a very small percentage because, first of all, if you look at the MAP tests, for instance, at this point, it doesn't test what's being provided in terms of information in the classroom. Many times with these standardized tests also, they don't reflect what's going on at home, in a student's home. It doesn't reflect what's happening in terms of possibly the student is an English language learner. Maybe they're hungry. Maybe they don't have a home right now. It doesn't reflect that. I just don't think that's fair to evaluate a teacher based on a student's performance in that sense.
Now, ed reformers like Michelle Rhee say we need to factor those out, and then if we do factor them out, we'll still see who are the effective teachers and who aren't.
We haven't yet. There is no test devised at this point that does that.
I noticed that you folks are bringing Diane Ravitch in, I guess next week, right? In the next week. Diane Ravitch has long been associated with education thinking. She has moved from somebody who talked about charter schools and the ideas of education reform in the establishment to somebody who says we have to take in environmental factors. We have to take in how a student is living outside the realm of the classroom in order to better serve that student. But we're at this conundrum, are we not, right now, with how do we proceed with the basic goal, making sure kids are graduated to be able to read, to be able to write, to be ready for citizenship and a workforce. Where do parents come in that? Because I get the impression from all the reading I've been doing at Seattle Education Blog that that's an important part of the puzzle that you think has been left out.
It has been. Because of this push in ed reform, which is backed by big money, what's been happening is that the people with the most money have had the largest voice. They've had the biggest say. Parents have been left out of the conversation, as well as educators. At the Seattle level, for instance, though, I admire what our superintendent is doing, bringing in those voices, bringing in parents at a grassroots level, bringing in teachers and having those conversations. We didn't have that opportunity before now.
Of course, he's also dealing with an insurrection, and he's trying to hold his authority at the high front by saying, look, you're going to give these MAP tests, Garfield High School teachers. We'll talk about it, but this is the rule right now. What do you think of what he's done there?
I think at this point he has a very difficult road to travel. Yes, he is trying to be superintendent, but I'm also hoping that he sees that what they're doing in terms of using the MAP test to evaluate the teachers doesn't make any sense to do.
Dora Taylor is involved in education reform efforts. You're a parent. You've seen good teachers and bad teachers. How should, you have a choice between two teachers in your child moving forward in school. One that you know is a good teacher, one that you feel confident is not a good teacher. You want your child to be with the good teacher, I imagine. So what do we do with the teacher that is not considered good?
What they have done in terms of the system with SEA is that,
Seattle Education Association.
Right. Is that if a teacher is seen as that, they will take them aside and support them. They will provide whatever additional education they think that they need. They will counsel them. If at a certain point it's not working, then they're let go. That's part of the contract that they have with our district.
How long do they have usually? Do they have 3 years?
I don't know for sure.
Do you? What breaks this logjam in the broadest sense? Again, I come back to the broad sense. If the charter school movement or the voucher school movement does not bring, the argument is we bring either threat of or actual competition, and through competition we'll get better schools. You've pointed out the other approach, Nova, Top, Salmon Bay, which was parents and teachers pushing the district to make changes, right? That didn't come easy either. So what are some of the levers by which we get better education, better teachers for our students?
Well, I think first what we have to do is value teachers. At this point in our society, looking at, for instance, what a basketball player makes versus a teacher, you can see exactly where we put our money and what we value the most.
So pay them more from the beginning.
Absolutely, pay them more.
What's a good starting salary, do you think, for a teacher today? Average.
Oh, off the top of my head, I'd say $65,000.
What are they at now?
I don't know. I'm sure it's lower than that.
Yeah, not a lot, though.
Yeah.
Depending on the district, of course.
Right.
When you look around and see successful districts, Bellevue, Highline, do you see any models there along the lines of the models that you listed that are working, teacher and administrator and parents working together well?
I don't know specifically, but I've heard that Aviation High School is very successful in that sense. They're very happy there with the program. I think that's another successful model to look at.
By the way, you're a public school parent?
My daughter graduated 2 years ago.
From?
Nova. But I'll tell you, she started out in private school. She went through seventh grade in California. We moved to Mercer Island for my work. I chose Mercer Island because the WASL scores were very high there. Put her in school. When she was in private school, she did not have a standardized test. It was a well-rounded education. At the WASL, because of No Child Left Behind, it was very important for test scores to be high. Because of that, teachers taught to the test. I saw this myself. My daughter used to love math. Because I taught to the test, it was simplified, too simplistic for her. She lost interest in math and science.
Hmm.
I found it, and she said, "Mom, those kids, they know how to take a test, and I don't." And yet they would come out of the classroom, but they couldn't discuss it on any other level besides, you know, what was A, B, and C. That's how I found Nova. At Nova, they did not do that.
And Nova's a public school. All right. Dora Taylor is a writer at the Seattle Education Blog. We have links to that organization as well as Parents Across America. It's a tough discussion. I hope we have it again. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a weekday.
. 9:38. We're going to talk about what it's going to take to win the White House in 2016 in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is Jack Spear with NPR News. You've heard us say it many times, and it's still true. You are the public in public radio. Everything you hear on KUOW is only possible with your support. So if it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. And thank you.
44 degrees in Seattle, and the forecast calls for rain. We're looking at a high today of 46. Rain overnight, a low of 41. Tomorrow, Friday, windy and rainy with a high of 49. I'm Bernard Willett. It's 9:39. There's a new musical about the women who rocked Seattle during the heyday of grunge. KOW's Marcy Silman will tell us more about that in 15 minutes.
Now we take even a bigger look at what's happening in our world. To become president, you must be loved by your party's base. David Domke is professor and acting chair for the Department of Communication at the University. Yeah, why do they do that to me, David?
Chair.
You are chair of the Department of Education, Department of Communication at the University of Washington. Can you tell I have a little bit of a foggy head? I apologize. Yes, David Domke is chair of the Department of Communication at the University of Washington. Teaches courses on a variety of issues in media and communication, and he is giving a lecture series tonight, 7 p.m., Kane Hall, room 130 at the UW campus, part of Seattle Arts and Lectures Series, Seattle Arts and Lectures University, about the road to the White House in 2016. Good God. All right, full disclosure, maybe you want to rescind that. I'm gonna teach a class in the Department of Communication in April, if I make it that far. So thank you again for being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
And I apologize for butchering that entire introduction. Rule two, you have to be loved by your party's base. Bill Clinton, he was loved by the base.
For a while.
George W. Bush?
Absolutely.
Mitt Romney?
No, that's why I didn't win.
Barack Obama?
Absolutely.
All right. So how did they do that? How did they endear themselves to their base?
Well, so this is part of it's a five-lecture series, and tonight's number two. And the Seattle Arts and Lectures and UW Alumni Association are sponsoring these. And so what I agreed to do for this lecture series was look at five patterns that could be discerned from the two-term presidencies of the last three presidents, counting this one. So Clinton, Bush, and Obama are our three consecutive two-term presidents, and we haven't had that since Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe in the early 1800s. So there's maybe something that we can glean from looking at their successes. And what's particularly interesting about them is that it's Democrat, Republican, Democrat, and that's very much different than what Jefferson, Madison, Monroe were. So rule two, looking at these folks, is that you don't win either a first term, and you certainly don't win a second term, if you're not beloved by the party's base. Now, what's the base? The base of the party are those voters that are the most ardent voters for that political entity. They're the ones who turn out in primaries. This is what makes them so important the first time around. They turn out in primaries. And then second, they're the places where hope dies last among the constituents. So you got to get them to win the first time, and you if you lose them, then you've lost everybody for the second term.
Jimmy Carter?
Yeah, Carter's a great example. I'll be talking about him tonight, contrasting him with Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Carter starts out with the great support of the base of the party, which at that time was largely white liberals, but also a bit of African Americans. But then he loses them, and he loses everybody, right? Contrast that with Clinton and Obama, who today the base of the Democratic Party are clearly African Americans and a growing block of Latinos. By, again, base being the most ardent supporters and the largest group of ardent supporters. So African Americans were 24% of Obama's coalition in 2012. So white liberals, like the kind listen to this station on a regular basis, like to think of themselves as the base of the Democratic Party. And they are, but they have never been as strong of the base as they used to be back in the 60s and the 50s. So they remember those days of the anti-war period. But today, the base of the Democratic Party is really people of color.
All right. What does that mean for the Republicans in your view? What's the base? What's the actual base of the Republican Party?
That's an easier question, actually. You don't even have this kind of possible conflict between one group and another differences of agreement over who's the base. In the Republican Party, it's a no-brainer. It's a definitive answer, and that's white evangelicals. They were 38% of Romney's voting coalition in 2012.
So not necessarily Tea Party people.
No, there's a great overlap among white evangelicals and tea parties. There's Robert Putnam has written all these books about civic engagement and social capital, had a great op-ed in the New York Times during the 2012 election showing the incredible overlap between people who consider themselves evangelical or born-again Christians and people who consider themselves in alignment with the Tea Party. And the correlation was at about 0.8. So there's incredible overlap there. So really the Tea Party is not entirely, but the Venn diagram overlay with evangelicals is extremely high. So when you really say Tea Party, you're really talking about the mostly evangelicals in this country, white evangelicals.
David Domke is a professor. He's chair of the Department of Communication at the University of Washington. He's giving a series of lectures, winning the White House in 2016, Five Rules for the Road. There's one tonight. There's one in March, April. There's one each in March, April, and May. We're going to come back and talk to him about each of those because it's interesting. So given what we hear about the Republican Party being in disarray and how do they expand their umbrella,
yep,
that's not quite the same as expanding your base.
No, expanding the umbrella means holding the base and pulling in others. That's what Reagan did with the, you know, the Reagan Democrats.
Do you have to remake the base at some point? That's what the Republicans are wondering.
Yeah, right? They will. They will have to. But remaking the base is not necessarily changing the base. It's getting the base to either moving with the base on some issues that some folks, some in the umbrella don't want to go with, or getting the base to change their positions. Just an example of this is right now with Marco Rubio. Rubio is beloved among Tea Party members, and a great Pew poll out just today shows that Rubio's public approval among people who identify the Tea Party is like 70-7, okay, extremely positive. But where was Rubio this week? Rubio's in Israel, and he's talking to people there, the leadership there. And yesterday he said that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. So what's he doing there? He's appealing to white evangelicals who, again, overlap with Tea Party. But here's what makes Rubio even more fascinating right now, is that Rubio is the primary Republican leader on immigration reform. Turns out that white evangelicals strongly support immigration reform. It's one place where they break with the Tea Party. Okay, with people who, this is, so someone who self-identifies with Tea Party and white evangelicals face a conflict on this. I think white evangelicals win on this in the Republican Party. They're a larger group of people. They've had a longer impact. So Rubio can help to remake the base around immigration, but he's not going to walk away from the importance of Israel. He's got to shore that up too.
So by that token, by that notion then, we can say that Rubio is walking down the road to 2016?
He is right now. If this was 2015, I'd say he looks good. But it's 2013, and it's really hard to be the early favorite and the late favorite.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to be both. In 2005, Barack Obama was a phenomenon, but he wasn't being touted as the next president. Because the Republican Party is in such disarray right now, Marco Rubio is being touted. And I think that actually hurts him. I think that it's tough to be this high profile this early. Because you know what happens if you become high profile this early?
You're a target.
Yeah, you're the target. Everybody wants to go after you, including most of the people in your party who want the nomination.
All right, well, let's look at the Democrats for a minute.
Sure.
Let's look at 2016 and the Democrats. What's the language that people need to use to win the base, to hold the base in 2016? But what's the language they use now? I mean, given that you have President Obama in power, he's got a lot of issues he wants to deal with. What's the language these folks are using?
Well, Obama's interesting. So I'll answer your question directly on language and issues, because there's two pieces there, is rhetoric and issue positions. But your question earlier was, can you remake the base or not?
Mm-hmm.
So the base of the party, I argue, is African Americans. Obama took a position on gay marriage, same-sex marriage, that seemed thought to run counter to many among that base. Well, some of them have shifted their positions, and others just said, you know, it's not that big a deal to me, okay? So he didn't lose the base in taking that position. So you can remake the base if through the power of your relationship with them, or they can remake themselves and just say, that issue's not that important to me anymore. So the positions for the Democratic Party that really matter right now, number one is a kind of a commitment to, I think, education and economic opportunity, an unwillingness to throw the middle class under the bus. This is where Obama has won back white liberals substantially, is this unwillingness to compromise on tax cuts in the same way. It's unwillingness to cut Medicare easily. And he's pushing education quite a bit too. So there's that. There's that piece. Then there's the symbolic element. The symbolic element right now is, in my view, quite clearly commitment to same-sex marriage. All right. You will see Hillary Clinton in the next couple months give a couple high profile speeches in which she will do the one thing that she needs to do to win over the white liberal base, a white liberal component of the Democratic Party, and that's to embrace same-sex marriage. She never could do that as Secretary of State while Obama was making this move and Biden was making this move. Clinton couldn't do that because she was dealing with all these international, these nations where that just wouldn't fly. But now she has to do that. And so she'll do that. So she has to do that in part to repair that hurt that many people feel over her support for the Iraq War. And African Americans strongly oppose the Iraq War. This is partly how Obama won him the first time around. So to me, it's a commitment to domestic policies and a commitment to the new fairness issue of same-sex marriage.
By the way, if embracing the base is step four, so 3, 7, 13, step two. What's step three?
Step three is understanding the primary system and what are the maps to winning the primary system. These early states really matter. They tremendously matter. So you've got to know as a candidate how to navigate those. And that's where Clinton made her debacle, her fatal mistake in 2008 is she tried to win Iowa, which is her worst state.
Oh, don't give it away because tonight is embracing the base. David Domke is a professor, chair of the Department of Communication, Seattle University lecture, winning the White House in 2016, Five Rules of the Road. Tonight, Kane Hall, room 130. He'll be
7 p.m.
7 p.m. He'll be talking about embracing the base. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
This is Weekday.
Forty-four degrees and mostly cloudy in Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the City of Seattle, working to stem pollution in the Lower Duwamish Waterway by offering tips and tools such as how to dispose of hazardous materials, prevent spills, and stencil storm drains. More information online at seattle.gov by searching Protect Duwamish.
Marcy Silman is here now with Art of Our City. Hello, Marcy.
Hi,
how is the Art of Our City?
It's healthy as always, thriving.
I like this topic a lot because this looks back to how the Art of Our City arrived here.
Well, some of the
20 years when we were covering these folks.
That's right. About some of you may have been here in 1991, where Seattle's music scene was kind of like all of a sudden the it music scene in the world. That was the era of the so-called grunge bands.
So-called,
because many people don't like that term. But that was the year that Nirvana put out Nevermind. And once that went mega platinum, this was the place where everybody came. And there were a lot of retrospectives a couple of years back on the 20th anniversary of Nevermind. And they were all really great, except that one thing was missing.
Where were the ladies?
The women who played in Seattle, these weren't like the ultra-feminist riot girl bands that were in Olympia. These were women who played. A lot of the bands were co-ed, if that's the right word for a band. And a lot of the women had their own bands like Seven Year Bitch and Hammerbox, fronted by a woman, Hell's Bells. And so Greta Harley, who had such a band, Danger Gens, and her musical partner, Sarah Rudnoff, who you may know from theater, went on a songwriting retreat because they have a band called We Are Golden, a duo called We Are Golden. And instead of coming up with songs, they had this idea that they would write a play about women much like themselves in their 40s, looking back to that heyday and sort of what all happened when people hit it big, what happened to the women, and what happens when you hit middle age. And that play, These Streets, is opening tomorrow night at ACT Theater. The script is actually based on oral histories with more than 30 women musicians from the Seattle area. A lot of them don't live here anymore. Elizabeth Kenny, the playwright, came and helped wrangle all that material into a show. There's going to be a live band on stage, fronted by Greta Harley, featuring a lot of folks who played back in the day and still play. And so we thought we'd bring them into the KUOW studios. This band's going to be covering a lot of tunes from the day, or days of yore, as somebody said to me. But they also, We Are Golden, Sarah Rudnoff and Greta Harley, wrote some tunes for the show, and this that we're going to hear now is I guess the title track from the show. It's called These Streets,
but recorded in the KOW
in the KOW
studios, right?
Performance Studio 2 weeks ago. So here you go.
Live music recorded, but performed live in our KUOW studios, our performance studio, a couple of weeks ago from Greta Harley and her co-creators of a new show, These Streets, which is opening Friday, tomorrow night, ACT Theater, part of the Central Heating Lab, looking back on 20 years of women who helped create the what we're calling grunge. I know some of you label folks, but we need a handle. You can hear a whole story, interviews and the like that Marcy did with them later on KOW Presents and tomorrow morning on Morning Edition, and lots more music and pictures as well for you to listen to at our website, kuow.org.
And now, the sound of the day.
There are sounds all around us, right? That strange sound is the sound of weekday listener Lori's husband, George. He's walking their dog along 32nd Avenue Northwest. His coat is brushing against the laurel bushes as they walk. Wow, talk about cool overtones. What's the fabric of that coat? Nylon sort of thing, ribstop. That's interesting. Great sounds just while you're walking along, see? Just in the daily routine. So listen to the sounds around you, if you would. Record the interesting ones. Well, they're all going to be interesting. We want to hear them. So stick your smart device down there, record 30 seconds. Tell us the story through sound of your regular day. Record 30 seconds, email it to us, weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. We want to hear what the world sounds like. We're looking forward to hearing more of your sound. Dow Constantine is coming up. Also, we'll take a look at one of the great writers of the golden age of radio. Stick around.
A massive explosion today near Syria's ruling party headquarters in Damascus killed at least 53 people. A full news update just a minute away. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance's new Proton Therapy Center, a partnership with ProCure Treatment Centers. SCCA's new Proton Therapy Center allows doctors to precisely target cancerous tumors.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.